Hello. You're about to listen to one of our audio-only webcasts, which was taken from one of our popular video webcasts. We'd love to get your feedback on how valuable and effective this format is for you. After you listen, please take a couple minutes and go to www.webcastaudio/survey to complete a quick evaluation. That's webcastaudio.com/survey. Thanks for the feedback and enjoy this podcast.
And again, I'd like to welcome you to today's TechNet webcast. This is how Microsoft IT defends against spam, viruses, and email attacks. It's my pleasure to introduce today's presenter. We have Umesh Desai, and he is a Microsoft IT systems engineer. So, Umesh, I'm going to hand it on over to you and let you take the floor.
Good. Thank you, Janet. Hi, everyone. I think I should say good morning, good afternoon, and good evening to everyone. I am in Seattle time, Pacific time. Good morning. My name is Umesh Desai. I'm systems engineer in Microsoft IT. Before we start the presentation, let me take a minute and explain what Microsoft IT is. Microsoft IT is no different than any other IT shop, and we do have similar goals like any other IT department to keep our messaging infrastructure secure, keep our users happy, and keep spam and viruses out of our environment. And that's what we are going to talk about today. We have pretty good content to cover today. We will talk about the brief overview of messaging hygiene, how we define messaging hygiene. Most of our content is focused on Microsoft Exchange Server 2003 messaging hygiene feature. I'll be talking about how we deployed those features, what those features are, and how can you benefit from those. The session will be distributed into the anti-spam infrastructure and antivirus infrastructure. And I'm very happy and excited to share with you all today that as of last week, we are live with Exchange Server 2007 Edge Server in our environment. And this is the going forward, we will be primarily based on Exchange 2007 Edge Server for all our messaging hygiene needs. I do have a couple slides that I would like to share and explain what was the primary reason of us deploying and how we wanted to deploy Edge Server and what's the upcoming design. So let's get started. Prerequisite for this session, this is a level 300 course. It's highly recommended to have basic understanding of SMTP protocol, internet email, Exchange Server 2003 transport and routing concept, basic understanding of domain name systems, and general concepts about antivirus and anti-spam. Let's start with a simple definition. What is messaging hygiene? The objective is pretty simple. Maintain a corporate messaging environment that is free of malicious and unauthorized content. The goal is simple and clear. What's important is understanding what should I keep myself protected from? And as you see in the bottom of the slide, I have listed some threats which are very common. And that's going to be our focus area for today, how we address those threats. I don't have to say anything about virus and spam messages. We all know why it's important to get rid of those. Denial of service attacks. Normally, when you are under a virus or a spam attack, the denial of service attack will happen on your infrastructure. And a DOS attack means it takes your service or a server out of routing or becomes unresponsive. Directory harvesting attack. For spammers to be successful, what they need is a valid email address of your organization, of all the users in your organization. How can I get that? There are a number of ways. And one of the most common tactics they follow is they try to do directory harvesting attack. They have simple tools and they use a dictionary type attack, connect to your server, and try to guess all valid email addresses. We will see how can we address that and how can we protect ourselves. Email spoofing. Spoofing, you don't want your users to get confused with email from someone which is not intended to be. Unauthorized mail submission, or which is also known as open relay. For maybe due to simple configuration error, someone, spammers, are using your infrastructure for spamming the rest of the world or rest of or your own infrastructure. What should we do, and how can we keep ourselves protected from such incidences? And finally, phishing. I would like to just briefly explain what a phishing attack is. In a phishing type attack, spammers or hackers use a social engineering tactic, and they mislead users in giving them a personal financial information. And most common phishing type attacks happen with PayPal, Citibank, or most financial organizations, in which case a user receives an email that looks like coming from a financial institution, and it's asking user to give up some personal information. Now, I know a quick example. I got an email from a Citibank and asking me that they just updated their systems and they would like me to make sure all my information is correct. Now, it was clearly visible to me that this is not a valid email, and the reason is I don't have a Citibank account, so why should I receive an email from Citibank? But I'm sure when 1,000 emails go, 10 users do have a Citibank account, and they don't know whether this is valid or invalid, and they will end up answering to those emails. So, going forward, quick overview of Microsoft's internet email environment. Our primary domain is at Microsoft.com, but we do accept email for a number of different other domains. And some examples are Xbox.com or Windows.Microsoft.com or WinSC.Microsoft.com, and such more domains are accepted in our internet mail infrastructure. We get 8 to 12 million inbound internet email submission attempts every day, and this is like a normal day. This is a day when we are not under attack. 95% of these email submissions are filtered by our gateway servers as spam and viruses. So out of 12 million messages, almost 95% goes away, and whatever remains will get delivered to users' inbox or a junk mail folder. Outbound mail from all the Microsoft, around 500 to 700,000 emails are sent out to internet. How do we have our infrastructure configured? We have 4 internet email gateway points. It's distributed. First, for inbound and outbound, we have 2 locations. It's Redmond and Silicon Valley. We chose to have 2 geographically separate locations for business continuous purpose. And we also have regional gateways. Their primary role is outbound mail only. All of Microsoft's inbound internet mail only comes through 6 servers, which are in Redmond and Silicon Valley. But any regional user, for example, a user in Asia, when wants to send email out to internet, it will go through their regional Exchange 2003 gateway server. We have 6 primary Exchange 2003 servers doing messaging hygiene today. And as I said at the beginning, as of last week, we are live with Exchange 2007 H servers. So within a couple months, we will be completely migrated to 6 Exchange 2007 H servers doing the exact same role of a messaging hygiene. Messaging hygiene, it's annoying to user, but it's also a large hit to the infrastructure. And just to give you an idea of a normal day in Microsoft IT, at any given day, the recipient rejected by our directory lookup per gateway is anywhere between 20 to 30 recipients per second. And sometime when we are under attack, our static recipient filter reject recipients at the rate of 80 recipients per second. And if you want to put it into perspective, this could easily mean up to 50 to 100 million message attempts every day can happen. If we don't do this, if we don't have this recipient filters or recipient lookup, our gateway servers will have to accept so much email, process it, and then send it back as an NDR. On the right-hand side of the slide, I explain how we do messaging hygiene. It's a picture of a bucket, and what happens is when the mail comes in, it follows layers of anti-spam features which are running on Exchange Server 2003 today. The first thing that happens is connection filtering. Sender filtering is next, recipient filtering, And then we do sender ID check and IMF, which is intelligent message filtering. That's Microsoft's own anti-spam product. For the rest of the session, we will focus on each layer, each technology, how it works, and how we deploy it in Microsoft IT. Let's start with some basic principles on which we have our messaging hygiene infrastructure based. First principle, anti-spam must be done before antivirus. The reason is virus scanning is most of the time more performance sensitive than spam filtering. With spam filtering, if it's a spam message, what you do is you delete. With virus scanning, you might want to just clean the message and send it to the user. So if I can get rid of as much mail possible as a spam before I do virus scanning, I can save a lot of resources on our gateway servers. Antivirus must scan both inbound and outbound email. We want to keep ourselves secure. We want to ensure that we don't get affected with viruses, but we also want to make sure that if we, for whatever reasons, we have infection inside our environment, we don't want to pass it on to our customers and partners. So what we do is we scan viruses, we scan mail for viruses in both directions. Antivirus must be email direction aware. And I'll give you an example why this is an important requirement for us. Let's say someone on the internet sends a virus to you and your infrastructure servers are configured to send a notification every time a virus is found and cleaned. If I'm outside, I'm a hacker or I'm a bad guy, I'm sending you a virus, every time my virus is removed, I get a notification back. Now let's say I develop a new virus and I send it to you. This time, I never got a notification back. What this tells the bad guy is, hey, I sent 10 viruses, they do have a protection for 9, but the 10th one, they don't have it yet. So what you want to do is, you don't want to send these notifications back to internet, but let's think other way. What happens if your employee is trying to send email to internet and you find a virus in that? You definitely want to notify your employee. So you want to control notifications in the depending on the direction of the email. So the first thing is this differentiating between what's inbound and what's outbound. And this was our key requirement when we looked at a virus scanning solution. I want to differentiate what's inbound, what's outbound, and apply separate policies. Antivirus must follow block-on-fail rule. In simple form, what this means is, for whatever reason, your virus scanning solution cannot scan a message for viruses, break the mail flow right at that moment. Do not pass messages without getting virus scanned to the next hop into your environment. And the last but very important, both virus scanning and spam filtering solution must integrate with Exchange Server. We are a Microsoft IT shop, and we have to ensure that all the solutions completely integrate with Exchange so that we don't have any break of Exchange functionality within our environment. Email messaging hygiene today, it's a layered defense. We have Exchange Server 2003, SP2 servers, Service Pack 2 performing messaging hygiene. And as you see in the diagram, mail from internet gets accepted by Exchange SMTP gateways. We have 6 of those, 3 in Redmond, 3 in Silicon Valley. On the first hop, we do all our spam filtering. Messages which are not spam go to the next hop, which is Exchange SMTP routing hubs. Again, Exchange 2003 SP2 server. That's where we do attachment filtering. We filter almost 40-plus different types of attachment before we go for virus scanning. And on the same server, we scan messages for viruses. Everything good, not a spam, no viruses found, mail goes to user. On the client itself, the Outlook has its own attachment blocking. Every desktop in our environment has a virus scanning, and Outlook also does its own spam filtering. On the left-hand side of the diagram, I have Exchange-hosted filtering listed. What we do is, if you know, this was primarily known as a FrontBridge Technologies, so it's a Microsoft subsidiary now. What we have done is portion of our inbound internet email we are routing through Exchange hosted filtering, and all the messaging hygiene functions are getting performed in the front bridge environment, which is called an Exchange hosted filtering environment, and the messages come back to our corporate environment. So let's get started and talk about each layer, how it works, how we have configured, and how you can benefit from that. The first layer, when the message comes, the first thing that happens is connection filtering with the help of real-time block list. If you are not familiar, connection filtering is an Exchange Server 2003 feature which you can configure with a third-party block list, or you can create your own IP block list. It's a DNS-based block list, and in a simple form, it checks the IP address of the sending server against a block leak using a simple DNS query. If DNS record for that sender's IP exists into the block list, which means there is a positive response back from the block list DNS provider, Exchange Server will reject the connection, saying that, sorry, I cannot access, but your IP address is blocked. With Exchange Server 2003, you have an option to support multiple block list providers, and each gets access in the list it's entered. So let's say you have three block lists into your Exchange configuration. The first one, it checks with the first one, IP found, rejects the connection. Not found, it goes to the second block list till the time it either finds a match or it exhausts all the block list entries. How does the rejection looks like when Exchange will terminate the connection? It will give a 500 level error, which is 555.7.1, and the text after that is customizable. So it's totally up to you how you would like to customize the rejection response. On the slide, I have given an example of how we have customized our gateway servers. And as you see, what we say is we rejected your email because your IP was listed on so-and-so block list. What should I do next? The next is contact the block list provider for assistance, or you can send an email to an email address at Microsoft.com. So the next immediate question is, if I am blocking your IP, how do I accept email to the email address in the error message? With Exchange 2003 and the connection filtering, you can specify a bypass address, which means that block the IP if it's on the block list, except for these email addresses. And this is an optional thing. If you want to configure, you can. You don't have to do it. But you are just keeping a way for someone who's getting blocked to send a mail to you for further assistance. And it supports customizable responses per configured provider. So every block list provider will have a unique response. Now, whenever I talk to customers, and if I go 1 year back, most of the customers do not have Exchange Server deployed with internet facing. They might have a third-party solution or a separate SMTP server that's internet facing. For connection filtering to work, the core requirement is the IP address itself. And if Exchange is not internet facing, it will never see the original IP address of the sending server. So with Exchange Server 2003, it wasn't possible to do connection filtering if your server is inside the perimeter or behind your own internal servers. With Exchange Server SP2, they provide a solution, and the solution is header parsing. What happens with Exchange Server 2003 SP2 is it has the intelligence so that when the message comes in and once you configure accordingly, Exchange will know that, hey, I am not facing the internet, but I'm behind my own internal server. So what I should do is I should go through the headers and find out the correct external server's IP address. Take that IP address and do a block list query. Let me quickly show you a diagram of how this will work. I'm just going to share an application. As you can see, I have two examples on this VSU, on the simple VSU. On the top one, I have Exchange Server 2003 gateway right on the internet. So I have an external SMTP server with the IP address of 1.2.3.4. submitting email to Exchange SP2 server. Perfect. Connection filtering is enabled. Exchange will take the IP of 1.2.3.4. Check with the block list provider. IP found. Block the connection. No issues. That's great. But let's say your Exchange server is not deployed internet facing, but it's inside perimeter and you have another SMTP server that's facing the internet. Now, in this case, if you don't have SP2, nothing can be done. You cannot use the connection filtering feature without Exchange 2003 SP2 because Exchange will always see the IP of your internal SMTP server, and that won't help you to block the connection. But you have SP2, and I'm going to show you a simple configuration that you need to do that will tell Exchange to go through the receive headers and find out the correct IP address. In this case, what will happen is Exchange knows I'm not on the perimeter, but I recognize this server, 10.20.30.5, that's my internal server, and I'll show you in a moment how it recognizes that, so just bear with me. So I should ignore that IP address, I should go back to the message headers and find out what was the next hop who gave mail to my internal server. Exchange finds the IP of 1.2.3.4. Now, this is not internal because that's how you as an admin would configure. Exchange takes that IP, checks the block list. If IP is found, it rejects the connection. So now that I have shown you the scenario how with SP2 you can deploy Exchange behind perimeter and still do the connection filtering, I would like to show you how will Exchange know what's internal and what's external. So let me go back to my sharing applications I have Exchange server in my lab, and I'm going to show you how do I configure my Exchange environment so that all these internal servers are correctly recognized as internal. I have opened Exchange System Manager. This is Exchange Server 2003 SP2 environment. I go to Global Settings, click on Message Delivery, and I open the Properties. Right on the General tab, there is an option which says Perimeter IP List and Internal IP Rate Configuration. If you go back to the scenario which we saw on the video, what you need to do is you need to add IP address of your internal SMTP server and all internal server which will send mail to Exchange server here. Once it's a one-time configuration, it's a global setting, all Exchange server in your environment will know about that. Once you do that, then you are good to go. You can deploy Exchange server inside your perimeter and still do the connection filtering. Let's get back to our presentation. So that's a huge benefit or a huge improvement from Exchange Server 2003 to SP2, which is enabling customers are like us also to deploy Exchange inside the perimeter. And most of the mail that we reject today, like I talked about, 95% of our email is rejected as a spam. And a good chunk of that email is rejected using connection filtering. When you are configuring connection filtering, how do you go finding out which block list to use? First, what you do, this is the process which we followed. We shortlisted the block list providers, and the criteria for finalizing was the quality of the block list and false positive rate. Some research around how the block list is, what their false positive rate is, how much does it cost me to use their block list, how simple it is to use their block list, and when I say quality of the block list, how do they list the IP address? Is it as simple as, I hate you, so I'm going to take your IP address and list this as a block list? Or I give the IP address, but the block list providers do follow a certain process before blocking that IP. On the other end, how easy it is to delist your IP address if you're blocked? Is it, again, as simple as, hey, I blocked, can you please unblock me? Or they expect you to provide a proof that, yes, you are blog because of certain reasons, and now I have corrected the problem, but I would like to unblock myself. Do they support DNS zone transfer? Connection filtering is a simple DNS query, and the rule of thumb is if your servers are going to do more than 250,000 DNS queries every day, it is good to have a local copy of the blocklist DNS database. So you would want to find out if they provide zone transfer. If yes, how much does it cost and how do I set it up? And finally, robustness and operational uptime. Once you configure your connection filtering, you are totally dependent on the blocklist provider's infrastructure for it to work. You don't have any control. So the questions you would like to ask is, how many DNS servers do they have? Are they all in one region? Are they distributed so that if one DNS server goes down, can I still be functional with rest of the infrastructure? So these are the criteria which we followed, and depending on your company requirement, you may have a same criteria or you may have a different criteria. The next layer in our spam defense is sender and recipient filtering. What it does is filter messages sent from an email address or domain. It's not like a real-time spam filtering. It still depends for you as an administrator to enter correct sender and recipient addresses that you would like to filter. But it's a very good temporary measure during mail bombing attacks. You are under attack and you're getting million messages in 1 hour and they are all from the same email address. What you want to do is you just want to add the sender address and Exchange will start rejecting those emails. What is beneficial is it will drop the connection before message payload is accepted. And I just want to take a moment and quickly refresh our memory about how a basic SMTP session looks like. SMTP server connects. The first command it gives is ELO or hello, depending on the version of a software. The next command is what's the mail from. The second command is receipt to, who is it going to. And then there is the data section. Connection filtering works as soon as you get the connection and the receipt to is entered. Sender recipient filtering also works mail from and receipt to commands. The benefit here is you haven't accepted any message payload yet. The message body or the message payload is entered only after the data command from the SMTP server. So by doing these three filtering techniques, you are rejecting messages right before accepting any message body, so less impact, less taxing on your servers, and your server is not responsible for generating a non-delivery report or an NDR because you haven't even accepted the mail yet. You may also want to filter messages with blank sender. This is optional. It's a checkbox which, if you want, you can configure. What that means is when users receive email, they don't see anything into the from address. And if you don't want such messages to enter your environment, there is an option which is filter messages with blank senders. Blocking on domain will break some scenarios. And why would people want to do that? What's spoofing? Spoofing is you getting email from your own domain. In its simplest form, what can I do? I use sender filtering and I say anywhere it says, let me give Microsoft an example. If the mail is coming as @microsoft.com, I don't want to accept it. Perfectly valid, it will work, but it might break some scenarios like listserv membership or if you have some business applications or vendor services which are outside of your company. They provide services to you, and they send email as @microsoft.com. So just be careful when you decide to block your own domain using sender filtering. If you don't have any dependencies, no listserv membership, or there are no applications who's sending email as your own company, I think this will be a great way to stop spoofed email messages coming in. And finally, recipient filtering is filtering messages sent to a particular email recipient. It could be a valid recipient, so it's a valid email address, but for whatever reason, it's under attack and you don't want to receive email anymore. You add it to a recipient filter, or it could be an invalid email address, which we'll see on the next slide. is called as recipient lookup. What does it do? It validates the recipient before accepting messages and returns a 550 protocol error. And let's say I go back to my SMTP session, I'm submitting mail from is accepted, sender is valid. Recipe 2, my email address is omeshd@microsoft.com. If I have recipient lookup enabled, if someone enters, if the remote server says omeshd@microsoft.com, Exchange server will say, yes, it's a valid user. But there is no omesh@microsoft.com. They take someone says omesh@microsoft.com. Exchange server will keep the connection on hold, make a query to Active Directory, and find out, is this a valid email address? This is called as directory lookup or recipient lookup. If not, Exchange will say, sorry, I can't accept mail because this is not a valid email. Now, just a quick note, all these features I'm talking about are there with Exchange 2003, but are not enabled by default. So you as an administrator will have to go and enable these features. But what's the side effect of doing this? And I talked about directory harvesting attack, where spammers or bad guys do a dictionary attack, and they just use a tool, start with a simple address, a@microsoft.com, aa@microsoft.com, and just go through list of combinations. So if I have my Exchange server configured to reply so quickly that I enter email address, Exchange will say valid, invalid, it could make things very easy for them. They just have to send few simple commands and find out what the valid email addresses are. Absolutely, and that is the side effect, which is directory harvesting attack. A quick note, like, if I don't have a correct protections in place, it could be 20 minutes to get all four character aliases by brute force elimination. How do I protect myself? The solution is delay the 550 response by N seconds. And N could be 5 seconds, 10 seconds, 15 seconds. It's totally up to you. So how does it benefit? I cannot prevent anyone trying to validate email addresses because that's a simple SMTP. If someone sends me a mail for invalid address, I have to either reject that mail after I accept or I have to tell during a protocol session. But by doing this solution, what you are doing is you are just being smart and you are saying, okay, I know this is not a valid email address, but I'm just going to wait 5 seconds, and normally what I say is I'll take my own sweet time to tell you that this is not a valid email address. With 5 second delay, something that was possible in 20 minutes could be months for someone to get all those four character aliases. So one, I cannot prevent anyone getting email addresses because I have to give them an answer whether by NDR or by protocol rejection, but I can make their life difficult. The caveat, it only works for authoritative domains with recipient within your Exchange environment. So if your Exchange server is configured for relaying any domain, this feature will not work. Next layer of intelligent message filter or IMF. Before we talk about IMF, it's important for us to understand a new Exchange 2003 infrastructure feature called as spam confidence level. And it's a feature, as I said. It's not a product or it's not a solution. What is it? It's a message property to indicate a certainty that the message is a spam or not. So message is accepted by Exchange server. It could be IMF, intelligent message filter, or any other anti-spam provider who understands this SCL value will assign a value or a stamp saying that I have scanned this message and according to me, this message gets a SCL rating of 9, which means I am 99 or 100% sure this is a spam. Or it will say I assign a SCL of 0, which means I'm positive that this is not a spam. So it's a feature, it's a property that gets assigned to a message. You don't have to have IMF, intelligent message filter, to use this feature. It could be any other product. A quick note, it's propagated within EXCH50 blob, and if you are not familiar, EXCH50 is an enhanced SMTP verb that Exchange servers will advertise. And that's the verb which is used for Exchange server-to-server communication. And in this verb, they communicate a lot of information. For example, rich text message information or SCL value information. So why is it important for us to know? Once you accept a message, once your exchange server accepts a message, assigns the SCL value, you want to ensure that this SCL value is kept all the way up to your mailbox server. And on the next bullet item, exchange server has two thresholds or action. What can you do with SCL value? The number one thing you can do is you can reject the email right on the boundary, right on the edge or at the gateway layer. And that's one threshold. Or you can say that I assign a SCL value, but for certain SCL values, I want to deliver mail to junk email. I don't want to reject this because I am not 100% sure, but I am not very positive that this should go to inbox. So mail can go to a junk email folder, which is an Outlook 2003 feature. For that to happen, the SCL stamp should be preserved from your gateway server where it gets stamped first all the way to the user's mailbox server. And this value goes inside EXCH50 blob. On the next slide, I'll explain what will happen if this blob is not preserved. Couple caveats. Outlook does not use spam confidence level for list filtering. You can expose the SCL value in Outlook, but Outlook has its own smart screen filter for spam filtering logic. And SCL value, SCL filtering does not affect any email that is submitted as authenticated. It only affects email that's submitted as anonymous. What values? -1 is reserved by Exchange 2003 for all the messages which are internal or authenticated, and otherwise you can have anywhere between 0 to 9. If you would like to see, if you are using a product, IMF or any product which does SCL stamping and you want to expose the SCL value in Outlook, there is a blog article which you can follow, and you need to install a simple control on your Outlook client and configure the Outlook view. IMF, we talked about connection filtering, sender filtering, recipient filtering. This is our fourth layer of spam filtering defense, for spam defense. It's Exchange 2003 product. If you have SP2, you don't have to do anything. It's installed by default, but if you are not using SP2, which I don't think will be the case at this time, everyone should be already on SP2, but if you are not, you need to install it as a separate application on the top of Exchange. I want to quickly explain the diagram on this slide. The diagram is SMTP architecture. That's how the Exchange 2003 SMTP is built. It has separate components like mail comes in, it goes for submission, gets categorized, and then goes out. At each stage of SMTP mail routing within Exchange server, you can have event syncs configured or a transport event syncs configured. So depending on where transport event sync is linked, the event sync is fired when that action happens. And IMF is hooked up to the end of data sync. And as you see from the diagram, as soon as message body is accepted and the remote server issues a command, carriage return, period carriage return, which completes delivery of message, IMF will kick in. It will take the message, scan for spam, assign a SCL value, and then it will go to the next hop. IMF will only scan messages which are submitted to SMTP protocol. So if you have an Outlook user who is submitting using a MAPI, using an Outlook, it will not go through IMF scanning. So quick important points: when you deploy IMF and you do want to utilize both the thresholds, you do want to filter some mail on the gateway for SCL threshold. Just to give you an example, let's say for any messages with SCL of 8 and 9, I want to reject, but any messages with SCL 5, 6, 7, let it go to junk email. Gateway, you don't have to do anything, just install IMF, Exchange will reject. But for junk email feature to work, you have to ensure that the SCL value is preserved all the way through the mailbox servers. And on the slide, I have an example. Mail comes in, exchange assigns a SCL stamp. Step one, in case one, what happens is exchange delivers that message to a third-party SMTP server, which is not authenticated, and they do not understand EXEH50 block. When that third-party SMTP server sends message to a mailbox server, as you see, you've lost the SCL value, which is in the EXEH50 block. But your gateway server directly talking to mailbox server on authenticated connection, and they do transmit EXEH50 block, the SCL value will be preserved. So it's a small thing, but it's very important for you to ensure the end-to-end, for feature to work end-to-end. IMF can be customized for different actions on the gateway. One thing is you just want to scan, but you don't want to take any actions. Just assign the SCL value. You want to monitor the counters and see what's happening. You can archive the messages. You can delete those messages, or you can reject at the protocol layer. MSIT action, or Microsoft IT, currently does reject with IMF. And as I explained earlier, like recipient filtering, sender filtering, which happens at the protocol layer, IMF reject will also happen at the protocol layer. So after the message is submitted and if exchange is configured for reject, exchange will keep the SMTP session on hold, check with IMF, and if message needs to be rejected, the rejection will go during that session. What's the benefit? One, you don't The core benefit is you don't have to accept the message, then decide to reject and submit an NDR. Because if the return address is not valid, your exchange server will have to queue that mail until it expires. So rejecting as much possible at the protocol layer gives a great benefit, and it's a very good performance win. If you want to customize the error message, again, if you don't have Exchange SP2, the default message is message refused. You cannot customize with IMF. But with SP2, there is a registry key, and you can type your own message, like, we rejected your mail because of some objectionable material, or however you want to format the text. Let's put all the features end-to-end. Mail comes in. It follows all the layers of spam filtering. If there is no action to be taken on the gateway, it goes to the next hop. We do attachment stripping and then virus scanning. Then it goes to end user. What happens on the mailbox server is mailbox server consults Outlook settings. For example, Let's take an example of a message with SCL value of 5, 6, or 7, and you have configured your infrastructure to send those messages to a junk email. Here comes a message with SCL of 7. Mailbox server says, I'm supposed to send this mail to a junk email because that's the setting. But user says that, no, this sender is in my contacts, and I do trust this sender. User always wins. In this case, the message will not go to junk email, but it will go to the inbox. Let's take it other way. Exchange server says that, okay, I got a message with SCL of 2, and I should deliver it to inbox. But user says, or Outlook setting says, no, this is the sender I want to block. User wins, the message will be delivered to junk email folder. Couple quick other things you can do in your environment to protect from spam. Distribution groups. Every company has large distribution group, and I'm sure every company has at least one which is like all employees, and which could be anywhere between few hundred to few thousand users. You definitely want to protect this large distribution groups. So what can I do? You can say, fine, I will restrict that who can submit to this distribution groups. And example on the slide is there is all employees, and you say only executives' email addresses can submit. But what happens if someone spoofs that email address? Exchange will accept and deliver. It's still restricted, but the email address is spoofed. So the best way to secure this large sensitive distribution group is, one, restrict to only few users, for example, executives, so that no one within in your company can submit, but you expect authentication. So if someone from the internet is trying to submit, they won't succeed because they cannot authenticate with your Exchange servers, and Exchange will reject those emails. So the screenshot on the right side is restricted and authenticated only. Spoofing, protection against spoofing. What's the spoofing problem? Spoofing is SMTP architecture. It's simple message transfer protocol and anonymous submission, which is the most common way of submitting messages on the internet. So that makes anyone to spoof and submit messages. It can happen with RFC 821 mail from address, or it can happen with 822, which is also P2 or a from address. Primarily target is the from address. And why? Because from is RFC 822 is the address which user sees. Anything that's in the RFC 821 header gets removed or stripped before mail gets delivered to the mailbox. So the primary target is always the from address. By default, Exchange Server 2003 will not resolve the from address. So can I prevent spoofing? Well, we talk about sender filtering, locking your own domain is one solution, but it may not work all the time. So other than that, I have to accept that email and send it to my user. But what can I do? How can I help my user to differentiate between what's really internal email and what's a spoofed email? Well, with Exchange 2003, by default, any emails which are submitted as anonymous, it will not resolve the from address. So when a user gets email, they will not see the display name from the global address list or the GAL, but what they will see is the one-off address, which is user@domain.com. And that will definitely alert them, or at least make them ask a question, and a little bit of user education within your company will help them differentiate between something that's internal and something that's coming from the internet. Again, resolve P2 information, which is the authentication status once message is accepted on the gateway server, is propagated in EXCH50 blob. So if you need end-to-end feature, you do want to make sure that from the gateway server, the first hop which accepts email all the way to the mailbox server, you do not lose the EXCH50 blob. If you have Exchange cross-organization configuration, for example, you have three Exchange organizations, but all internet mail is accepted only in org1, but you want to have this functionality when mail gets delivered to organization 2, make sure that the EXCH50 blob also flows from organization 1 to organization 2. It's a challenging, it's a little bit challenging, but it's important for feature to work. What can I do? I can do minimize the number of anonymous mail submission. Why spoofing happens? Because anyone can submit anonymously. If I only have authenticated, I just cannot connect to your server and submit email. And internally, sometimes there are applications which cannot authenticate. So you may have to be a little bit extra careful and lock down your server if you do need to accept mail anonymously internally. So make sure you log on your servers to accept mail from only those applications. So mitigating the spoofing problem for internet mail, you must support anonymous SMTP connection. We cannot expect everyone on the internet, and it's not a best practice for external parties or senders to authenticate against your environment. So you do need to accept anonymous email. So the first option is accept the message, but provide indication to user. And as I said, when user gets the mail, that's the right screenshot, they will not see the display name, but rather they will see the one-off address. How do I control that setting? It's right on the virtual server properties. Virtual server, if you go to authentication tab, there is a resolve anonymous mail checkbox. And I would like to quickly show you using Exchange System Manager. So I'm going to share my desktop. So I go to my Exchange 2003 gateway server. This is my lab environment. I will navigate to protocols, SMTP, and this is the virtual server which is accepting email from the internet. So let's give a couple seconds for it to open the properties. I go to access, authentication. Now this is the default configuration of Exchange 2003. If you are Exchange 2000, this is enabled by default. So what this says is, if mail is submitted anonymously, do not resolve, and the end user experience will be they will not see the gal name. But let's say you have some internal applications or within two exchange organizations which are internal, which submit email as anonymous, and you do want to resolve. So what you need to do is you just have to select the checkbox. And from this point, any mail submitted to this exchange server over anonymous connection will be resolved as internal email. Let's get back to our presentation. That's option one. What's option two? Option two is implement sender ID or a sender policy framework. What's sender ID? Sender ID is a published policy that defines who is authorized to send mail from a particular domain. And it's the second part of a sender ID framework is the receiving party who will verify and enforce that policy. So there are two parties involved, sending side and the receiving side. The job of a sending side is to publish information to internet or to the world that for my domain, these are the servers who are authorized to submit mail. What will the receiving party do? The receiving party, whenever they get email from the internet, they will check for this information. They will do a sender ID query and find out who is authorized to submit email for that domain name. If there is a match, they accept the mail saying this is authorized email. If there is no match, they might want to tag it as a spoofed email or for closed spam filtering scrutiny. It's a little bit of history. It's a merger of proposals from internet and messaging communities. Initially, it started as Microsoft's caller ID for email and sender policy framework. They merged together and now it's called as sender ID. If you do need to understand in detail how this framework is, the 5 technical drafts are available on the Microsoft.com sender ID website. I highly encourage going through those. It might take 5 to 10 readings for you to really get to the depth of it, but it's pretty interesting and I enjoy reading those. So sender ID is a way for senders to protect their brand. And why do I need? What's the disadvantage of spoofing? Spoofing causes a lot of impact on the brand name. For example, Microsoft won't want anyone to submit mail to outside Microsoft as Microsoft.com. It does have impact on our own brand name. So by sender ID gives us a way of protecting our own brand name by locking down, by specifying a policy and telling the world that these are the servers who can submit mail as Microsoft. If you get email from any other server, it's not Microsoft.com, just to give an example. And for receivers, it's a way to verify that information and take that information, the result of that information, and give it for your spam filtering solution. For example, IMF and sender ID work hand in hand. Sender ID on Exchange. Exchange will do the sender ID query and give that information back to IMF. It's a foundation for reliable use of SafeList. Just by having sender ID, you will not stop the spam, but it's definitely a step further to prevent spoofing and preventing spam. So how does the sender ID work? The first step is senders publish their IP addresses on outbound email servers, because that's something they have to do it and only they can do it. The second on the receiving side is they have to decide now which domain name should I take. And remember, sender ID is taking the domain name from the email address and verifying that a specific IP address or a sending server is allowed to send email as that domain. In SMTP, you have two from addresses. The one is RFC 821 mail from, two RFC 822 from address. It's up to receiving side, and when it's receiving side, it's the application who decides which domain name to pick. Exchange Server 2003 will always pick the RFC 822 from address for sender ID verification. So the two options are purported responsible domain, or also called as PRA check, which is from RFC 822 headers, or RFC 821 or 2821 mail from domain. Once receiver decides which domain to pick, they take the domain name and issue a simple DNS query asking for sender ID results. And I'll show you on my next couple slides how the sender ID records are formed. Display of how the sender ID works, one-time publishing of sender ID records into DNS, that's all, no other changes required. Sender submits the mail, receiver gets the mail, it decides which domain name to use, looks up the sender ID record, it found match positive filter input, there is no match, it's a negative filter input, and this information can be fed back to your spam filtering decision. How do I publish sender ID records? There are different ways you can publish, and let me share a couple, three examples with you. The first example says example.com, that's the domain name I'm publishing the sender ID policy for. The sender ID record type itself is a TXT or a text record type into the DNS. The version SP1, that's the sender ID version, and minus all. The first example is saying that no server should send email as example.com, and there are no IP addresses listed, and the minus at the end, minus before all, says that this is a hard decision, there are no IP addresses, and no one should ever submit email as example.com. So if you get email as example.com, that's definitely a spoofed message. The second example says it's exact same command, but only with MX added. And what it's saying to the world or to the receiving party is MX is used for inbound. Like when someone wants to send email to your organization, they use your MX record query. And what you are saying that all the servers which are inbound for us are also outbound for my organization. You can specify all IP addresses, or you can just put a reference to your MX type DNS query. The third example specifically lists a IP subnet, and which says that a specific IP address. And for example.com, only 192.0.2.0 can submit messages at that domain. And what options do I have for all? The first option you can have is ? What that means is when you publish a policy, you can say ? Tilde all, or a minus all. And we just saw the minus all. Minus all is you are 100% sure that whatever is in the sender ID record, that's completely authoritative. Tilde all is you are in the process of building up your sender ID record. So this information is partially authoritative. If you receive email from our domain from IP that's not listed here, it's quite possible that we might have missed it, or we will add it at a later date. ? All is completely inconclusive. You should not reject email, or you should not take that answer as a complete authoritative. And why would you do that? The reason is when you are initially building up a sender ID record, you want to research your environment and find out all the IP addresses that are listed in the sender ID record. And at some point, when you're 100% sure that, yes, these are the IPs, there are no other servers in my environment who will send email as this domain, I want to change my record as minus all. And that is just telling the world that this is 100% authoritative list. On the next slide, let's talk about the possible results you can have. So the status, the neutral, I won't go through its details, it's pretty self-explanatory. The one point I want to note here is Like IMF, you can delete, reject, or archive. With sender ID also, you have three options. You can accept the mail and just stamp the sender ID. You can delete the mail, or you can reject. But as you see from this table, the reject and delete option is only available if the sender ID query comes back as a fail. And when it fails, I have four bullet item listed. Only if a sender ID query result was this one of these four, your Exchange server can reject that email. So even though you have Exchange server configured to reject, but the sender ID query comes back with anything other than fail, it won't get rejected. Quick note, Microsoft sender ID record, just simple query, how do I find out? NS lookup, query type txt, Microsoft.com. The Microsoft, the first result tells you MX and it includes, it points to another sender ID record. And why did we do this way? With DNS record, there is a limit of 255 characters. You cannot exceed that. And clearly, with our IP addresses, we were exceeding that. So what we did is we did a sub-records like SPFA, SPFB, SPFC, and references to those records are into our primary record. Sender ID scope, it has limitation. It authenticates domain, not users. Validates last hop, not end-to-end. Spammers can register there on domains, absolutely. But it's a foundation for a reputation system, accurate allow deny list, and it's a better protection against phishing. How do I implement? First step, publish your sender ID records. Two, do the sender ID check for inbound email. With Exchange Server 2003 SP2, you can now do the sender ID check. If you don't have SP2, the sender ID option is not available. What do we do today? Our current MSIT action is set for accept. So, just want to take a quick look here, a quick moment here. We understand different implementation of Exchange servers now. You can have Exchange deployed on the internet or behind perimeter or behind your internal servers. This video explains you what happens, which filtering layers get fired up in what order. So I won't go through the details. It's again self-explanatory, but when the mail comes in, depending on the implementation on the perimeter or not on the perimeter, the spam filtering layer will fire in a different order. That was all about the spam filtering, what we do, and let's spend a few minutes and talk about Microsoft IT antivirus. Where can you do virus scanning? You can do on a gateway, you can do it on a store, you can do it on a client. Each method has a different requirements, different dependencies, advantages and disadvantages. Before we do virus scanning, we do attachment stripping. And why we do it is the protection from unknown malware. What happens if there is a new virus in wild and we don't have the signatures yet, but if I'm already stripping 40 plus different types of attachment, most likely I already filter that virus because viruses has to come as one of the executable formats. It's implemented as an add-on component on the antivirus solution on our gateways. It's done before virus scanning for performance reason. If I am going to filter an attachment, why should I scan that message and spend my virus scanning resources? All our file filtering list on our gateway server is kept in sync with Outlook 2003 level 1 attachment list. So whenever Office product releases updates their attachment list, we will also update the gateway server. Key principles for Microsoft IT antivirus, defense in depth is key. Try to do virus scanning at multiple layers. The question you ask is, do I need to do virus scanning everywhere, gateway, store, client? And then, yes, absolutely, but there are performance impacts or different dependencies. So the question you ask is, how much risk am I ready to mitigate? Can I do only two and still have a comfort layer? Because each layer you add to the virus scanning will have a performance overhead. We do the different treatment for inbound and outbound. Just scanning is not enough. Do attachment filtering, try to reject email as much as possible before wire scanning. For example, do the directory lookup. Security notification, I mentioned that control what goes out and what's internal. You may want to do message purging for worm-type viruses because they are not sent by any user. They are self-generated and self-propagated. So you don't want to send all those worm messages, clean them, and send it to users. And finally, what kind of metrics and reportings you can have. What do we have today? We are SMTP gateway focused. We are using, it's now Microsoft Antigen for SMTP 9.0. It's Cyberi. It's now Microsoft subsidiary. We do Exchange as a transport provider, and it integrates with Exchange at the event sync layer. Other possibilities, you can have a VS API-based solution that will run on Exchange Gateway server. Both options, transport API and event sync, Exchange supports, but usually vendor will have only one of them implemented. Just a quick note, when you have multiple scanning engines, we do use multiple scanning engines in our environment. All engines are engaged for each messages, and our environment is configured for maximum certainty. Even though one virus is caught by one engine, it will still go through all other scanning engines. Like, as you see here, we have some sample viruses, and this virus was caught by all five engines configured in my environment. Now, depending on each engine's effectiveness, it's never that all viruses are caught by all engines. Like here, only three engines caught that, only two engines. And in this example, this virus was caught only by engine three. So having multiple scanning engines and with max certainty really helps us keep us secure. So coming back to our SMTP architecture, how does spam and virus scanning work together? The first thing, IMF hooks to end of data, and then you, for virus scanning, you can either do with the VS API solution, which is hooked to on submission or after post-CAT event sync. A quick note here is if you have a spam filtering solution that also works on a post-CAT or post-categorization in SMTP, you do want to set the priorities so that spam filtering will fire first and the virus scanning solution will fire next. Protecting against denial of service attacks, it's extremely difficult. There is no one button or one switch which will say, okay, I do this and I'm protected against this, because most of the time when you're under a spam or a virus attack, that will happen as a denial of service attack. It could be at a messaging layer where you get like million messages in 1 hour or few hours, or it could be at a networking layer where someone is taking all your available connections and valid legitimate people cannot connect and submit messages to you. So what can you do? Make sure you have virus scanning and spam systems up to date and correctly configured. Set the limits, because what happens if I don't have limits and one sends you a gig attachment with 100 messages. If your server only has 10 gig of disk space, it will take all, and if it has to queue those messages, it will take all the disk space. When disk space goes down to zero, Exchange services stop. Implement authenticated only distribution groups. Set max recipient restriction. Don't allow even within your organization to allow every user to send messages to everyone. Do criteria-based filtering like sender recipient filtering, connection restrictions, and manage relay for inbound and outbound. And nothing beats proactive monitoring. You don't want to wait till your server goes down. If you have a proactive monitoring measures, for example, you're monitoring queues on the server and you notice that for this domain in last 1 hour I have 10,000 messages queued, you can take some action immediately before the 10,000 messages become 100,000 and takes your server down. On the client side, what can I do? With Outlook, you have attachment blocking or script stripping web beacons. Web beacons is where you get an email and it has a graphic. When you open a graphic, an active code runs in the background and sends a signal back to the sender that, hey, the user just opened this mail, which means this is a valid user address. Users can have their own trusted or junk senders list. and client-side spam filtering, there is an update for junk filter. And the final note is Outlook client version control. In Microsoft, what we do is whenever we have newer versions of Outlook released, we block access for older versions for security reasons. So this can be done by creating a registry key on the Exchange server so that we force all our employees to always run the up-to-date and the latest versions of Outlook, which has more security fixes, which has fixes from the older versions. So that's how we are doing today, and that's how we have been doing till last week when we went live with Exchange Server 2007-8 server. I do want to share, since I'm so excited, it's just last week, and I'm very happy to see that we have taken a step to further secure our environment. So I thought maybe this is a good idea to give a couple pointers. So going forward, like, I'm sure we will have a webcast which will primarily focus on how we deployed Exchange 2007-8 server and how we do messaging hygiene and what our experience has been. I don't have a lot of data right now to share because it just last week it went live. But in next couple slides, I'm walking you through with the key design points and key deployment decisions we did. So, like, what challenges we have today? And as I said, like any other IT organizations, our thinking is pretty much the same. We have an infrastructure to protect. We have a service to give to the users. And we do have challenges. We are a Microsoft IT shop, though. Only difference is we do a lot of dog fooding, but the challenges remains the same. So Exchange Server 2003 servers need Active Directory for them to function. You cannot install Exchange 2003 server without Active Directory. And our gateway servers are today dual-homed, which is we have one network interface facing internet, and we have another network interface facing the internal or corporate network, and they are forming a bridge between the two. So we have these dependencies. The risk is, with this setup, we have a risk of exposing internal corporate network resources and prone to more denial of service attacks. So I want to introduce Exchange 2007-8 server. This is not a marketing slide, but I just want to talk about a few features of Exchange 2007-8 server. It's a platform for spam filtering and virus scanning. It's also a platform for secure email going forward. You can do like TLS encrypted email with customers or business partners. And the key win with 8 server is you don't have to make it part of Active Directory. So you can install 8 server in a perimeter network and just have all messaging hygiene functions that Exchange 2003 offers you today. No compromise, all the features, plus some great new features like protocol analysis, which is learning as it receives the traffic from IP and deciding if this IP is a spammer or should I block it, or respecting Outlook safe list. For example, if Outlook user says, I always want to receive email from this sender no matter what, this information can now be pushed to Edge server so that Edge server can respect that and it will not filter those emails. And finally, it gives you option like spam quarantine. So with Edge server, you can do all the messaging hygiene we talked up till now in last 1 hour, plus you get some new features. Okay, waiting for next slide. I have a couple more slides to go. Okay, so how are we planning to deploy? This is our corporate internal forest will look like or looks like today. We have Exchange 2007. Today we are in a mixed mode. We still have Exchange 2003 and 2007 servers. The 8 servers, which I just explained, will be deployed into perimeter network. And as you see that they sit between two walls, two firewalls, and internal network is protected from the internet by having 8 servers in between. So Mel comes in, goes through all the messaging hygiene functions, everything clean. It will also do virus scanning. The clean mail will go to the internal infrastructure. So with Edge server, that's all you need to do. And you have a corporate server that's protected by multi-layer security. You have Edge server with all the messaging hygiene functions, no compromise, and still achieve the security. But for the management point of view, and we have like an operation team of 20 people, and we wanted to ensure that it's easy for us to manage the Edge servers, we decided to make them part of a totally separate Active Directory forest or Active Directory. Now, this is no way linked to a corporate Active Directory. So Edge servers don't need Active Directory, but purely for management and administration, they are part of Active Directory so that operators can log in and manage these servers. Just a quick note about what ports do I need. I only need port 25 from internet for SMTP mail. I need port 25, 53, and port 80. That's going outbound from Edge server to internet. And most importantly, I only need port 25 from the perimeter network back to my internal network. And this is a huge win and a security win. And going from corporate network to DMZ or perimeter network, port 25, terminal service edge port, and the edge sync port. That's the functionality with Exchange 2007. To summarize, best practices with antivirus and anti-spam, implement layer defenses, do virus scanning for both inbound and outbound, always do the spam filtering before virus scanning for performance improvement. Test your antivirus solution on various message formats and attachment formats so that with that solution, you don't really break any user functionality. Configure gateway virus to be direction aware, and at the gateway, consider block on fail, configure antivirus to purge worm-infected mails, do attachment filtering, and do not send security notifications to the internet. The session summary, we talked about messaging hygiene, messaging hygiene features of Exchange 2003, and very quick overview of how we have deployed Exchange 2007 Edge server. And I do want to apologize for a little bit of, I just went beyond my allotted time, but I just wanted to take this opportunity and share as much as possible. So for more information, I have listed some links here. All the messaging hygiene, we also have a white paper published which was updated a couple months back, and it talks about what we do with Exchange 2003 SP2. So you will find all this information in a greater detail in the white paper, which is available on Microsoft.com IT Showcase. That said, I think we do have a few minutes for a question answer.
Excellent. So Amesh, I'll just wrap up here real quick and let everybody know if they have any questions for you, go ahead and submit those now. You can go ahead and start taking a look at them and we'll answer them in just a moment. Want to point out that if you didn't get a copy of the slides, you can watch your inbox tomorrow. I have an email with information about viewing this webcast on demand. You'll be able to download this as a Windows media file. In that email, we'll also include a link to the downloadable PowerPoint of today's webcast. So, we do record all of our webcasts, so if you'd like to see any of our previously recorded webcasts, as well as anything that's coming up, everything's posted right there at Microsoft.com/webcast. I also like to point out that today's webcast was presented using the Microsoft Office Live Meeting technology, and there's a free 14-day trial. Just go to Microsoft.com/presentlive. Now, you should be seeing a survey now in your slide area, and I just want to point out if you hit that little registered online area, that'll take you right into our survey, and we appreciate your feedback. So if you just take a moment to fill out that survey before you log out, we do appreciate that. And I'm going to hand it back to Amesh, and I'll let him wrap up if you're able to stick around for any of these questions that we have in the queue. So Amesh, you want to wrap up?
Yes. Thank you, Janet. So we do have a few questions. Let me go through them. One of the question is, do we archive or reject messages based on the SCL level? So MSIT action for a gateway is reject. So if we get a message that exceeds our gateway layer threshold, what we do is we don't archive, we just reject that email. So, there is one thing I would like to make a note, and I always, whenever I talk about sender ID, I mention that a lot of customers ask me a question, what happens if, like, we do sender ID check, what happens if we don't have a sender ID record published? Are you going to reject our email? So if you go back to the table in my slide, the only scenario when a reject can happen is when the sender ID query fails, sender ID query results in a failed state. Not having a sender ID record published does not mean a fail. And in that case, your Exchange server or whichever application you are using will always have to accept that message and send it for spam filtering, send it for the next spam filtering layer. So let's go through. I think those are the only questions I have.
Okay, well, if there's no further questions, we can stay online for just in the next few minutes, and if any additional questions come in, we can answer those via the Q&A text window. So I'll just remind everybody that your feedback is valuable. If you could take a moment to fill out that survey before you log out, we do appreciate that. And with that, I'd just like to extend a special thanks to Amesh for today's presentation. Also like to thank you all for coming us, and that concludes today's TechNet Live meeting. So thanks again.
Hello, thank you for listening to this webcast. We value your feedback, so please take a couple minutes and go to www.webcastaudio.com/survey to complete a quick evaluation. Thank you.